I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Iraq's first freely elected National Assembly in half a century convened in Baghdad today to the sound of explosions, a series of bombings that appeared to be aimed at the gathering of politicians but did not injure any. Today's meeting is historic, but by the end of the one-hour session today, the country still had no president, prime minister, or cabinet. Joining us with an Iraq check-in is Borzu Daragahi. He reports for the Boston Globe and CBC Radio. He's in Baghdad. And Borzu, you were also at the meeting today. What was the mood?
I think among the politicians who were there, they were quite proud of themselves and quite happy. There's been a real frustration among a lot of people, ordinary people that I've been speaking with, about the extraordinary length of the time between when they voted on January 30th and the formation of a new government. And they were quite pleased with themselves at having finally met and at least done something.
And a very diverse crowd, we understand, robes next to Western business suits.
Yeah, absolutely. You had a lot of people from more tribal backgrounds and people from more secular backgrounds, you know, sitting next to each other. It looked like a picture of Iraq. There were quite a few women. There was women wearing headscarves. There was women wearing black abayas, common for Shia. And there was women, modern women, wearing no head covering at all.
Tell us about these explosions that we understand took place as people were still filing in.
Yeah, and there was a series of five or six explosions. They were outside of where we were at, the bubble, the security, huge, immense security bubble that we were inside to cover the opening of the parliamentary session. So, quite frankly, I don't know what had happened. And I you know, to be frank, I thought it was not that big of a deal for Baghdad, a few explosions going off. I think some of the media made more of it than it was.
Well, in fact, the politicians continued filing in, and it did seem to be, you hate to say it, but just another day in Baghdad.
Yeah, absolutely. Business as usual. I mean, gunfire, explosions, that's just daily life here. But it was a little, I thought it was a little overplayed among the wire services, just because it was so uneventful, this whole thing, this whole process.
Well,
you know, I talked to the British ambassador to Iraq, who himself said basically this changes nothing.
Well, in fact, the event was uneventful. Why was nothing accomplished?
I think there's a number of reasons. The primary reason is that the triumphant Shia and Kurds can't agree on a government. They've not been able to agree on a government, and they've been sort of taking their time. There's really no incentive for anyone to hurry up with this process. You know, the current Alawi government, the longer there's a delay, the longer they're in power, and the more, you know, sort of patronage jobs and things like that they can accrue for themselves. And, you know, the Shia and the Kurds are just kind of testing each other and pushing each other and trying to see who will give on a few key issues. Those key issues are Kirkuk, control over the oil-rich city in the north, and Peshmerga, the Kurds' 100,000-strong militia. The Kurds want control over that militia. They want budgetary control over that militia. The Shia says, no, 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 everything has to go through Baghdad. And the Kurds also want the Shia to be more accommodating toward Prime Minister Iyad Alawi's block of parliamentarians who lost big in the elections, but, you know, they're still in the government and they want a role.
Well, so what happens now, Borzu?
Well, I don't know. I mean, a few of the people that I spoke to said that, you know, we're still in negotiations, and hopefully, you know, inshallah, God willing, next week we'll have a government and we'll announce it.
In your voice, I'm wondering if I hear some of the frustration that we understand is in the streets as well, that you're perhaps reflecting some of the frustration of the Iraqi people.
I mean... For me, it's just a hard story to get at because, you know, none of the principals are talking honestly and candidly about what's going on. But absolutely, if you go out and talk to the people, and I was quite surprised at how astutely aware many of the Iraqi people are about what is going on with their government. They're saying, you know, we went and we risked our lives to vote, And these guys are delaying the process of creating a government. And meanwhile, services are not being restored. Meanwhile, infrastructure is not being repaired. Meanwhile, important positions are not being filled, and the country is not moving forward. We did our part. How about the government doing their part?
Well, Borzoo, while we have you, before we let you go, there's been another development in Iraq. Italy has announced it's pulling that country's troops out of Iraq, perhaps many assuming that's connected to the shooting death of the Italian intelligence agent 10 days ago. What's been the reaction in Baghdad?
Among the Iraqis, they're not very reactive to it. It doesn't really affect their lives. The Italian troops are in Nasiriya. They mostly stay on their base, and they don't cause a lot of trouble. They're not known as being particularly aggressive and so on. But I think among the U.S. and British diplomats, it's had a very electric effect. Many of them are rushing to sort of spin this. No, Berlusconi didn't mean what he meant and didn't mean what he said. And no one's pulling out, and everything is going according to plan. Everything's going to schedule. They were very much trying to prevent a free fall in the, or at least the perception of a free fall in this so-called coalition.
Borzoo Daragahi reports for the Boston Globe and CBC Radio. He spoke to us from Baghdad. And Borzoo, thanks so much.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Newly released figures show that since 2002, 26 prisoners in American-run overseas prison facilities have been killed under suspicious circumstances, and only one of those deaths took place at the now notorious Abu Ghraib facility in Iraq. This information has sparked outrage among human rights groups calling for a full-scale inquiry into U.S.-run prisons in Iraq and Afghanistan. Military officials say authorities are already investigating every case and that some of the deaths, which have largely been classified as homicides, were justifiable homicides and should not be prosecuted. Doug Gell is covering this story for The New York Times. He joins us now. And, Doug, can you tell us first, where did these new figures come from and why are they so significant?
They came from the Army and Navy in response to inquiries from the New York Times and perhaps other news organizations. They're significant because the fact that 26 apparent homicides have taken place is a number a lot larger than previously acknowledged by the military. We've heard numbers before in the neighborhood of six. This is quite a lot larger.
Right. And I'm wondering if we just could put it in context. These 26 deaths were out of 65,000 prisoners taken during the U.S.-led wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Human rights groups, many people would say one death is too many. But is anyone saying that's an acceptable equation?
No, I don't think so. But the context is important. The numbers of prisoners taken was great. The fact is, though, Army and Navy investigators who've looked into these deaths have determined that at least 26 were confirmed or suspected criminal homicides. In addition, there were at least 20 more that have been ruled justifiable homicides. But there are 26 cases that we're going to see in the military courts or have already gotten there.
And by the way, just another number to throw in, we read a total of 108 people died in total in American custody in Iraq and Afghanistan. And you mentioned, I think I added up to a little over 40. So how are the other deaths being characterized?
Well, there are about 30 that are attributed to natural causes. Another 25 or more in a mortar attack on Abu Ghraib back in 2004, mm-hmm. and the remainder 5 or 10 undetermined causes to date.
Well, in the cases that have been called homicide, is criminal action being pursued?
In most cases, it's on the track to pursue criminal action, but very few cases have yet resulted in court-martials on homicide charges. A couple cases are now nearing that point. We'll see some hearings next week, but some have been dealt with in what the administration, what the military calls non-judicial proceedings, and we have very few details about that, not even the names or penalty involved.
Well, what do we know? I was going to ask you to, if this sheds any light on the types of abuses that might be perpetrated. Again, there's going to be court cases, but, what types of abuses and what types of facilities? If only one death was at Abu Ghraib, where were these deaths?
we only have an incomplete picture. The Army and Navy have provided numbers, but only incomplete details of the events. We do know from that partial picture, though, that these are deaths at other facilities, some in Afghanistan, at Bagram detention facility as early as 2002. In one of those cases, two prisoners were beaten to death over an eight-day period in December 2002. Some of the other deaths were at other detention facilities in Iraq and Afghanistan. All of these are at detention in American detention, some in prisons, some simply in American captivity shortly after the point of capture.
Mm. Again, you said that some cases might be coming up soon. Can you tell us about any of those?
There's a case in San Diego involving Navy SEALs and the death of an Iraqi lieutenant general in November 2003. Most of those cases have been resolved through non-judicial hearings. There's a court-martial scheduled for Monday. The Bagram case, the deaths of two prisoners in December 2002, there's a preliminary hearing next Monday in Texas of a private first class who's among the first of those to be charged in those deaths.
Yeah. Doug Gell, you're still putting together the puzzle parts here, but does this report put Abu Ghraib in a different context? I mean, we remember that when the Abu Ghraib prison abuse photos came out, they caused an uproar. But as you are reporting, only, and I put quotes around that, only one death is reported at Abu Ghraib. Does this mean that Abu Ghraib was just the tip of an iceberg?
I'm not sure I would choose that metaphor, but I think it does demonstrate that that abuse, including abuse leading to deaths, was much more widespread in American detention facilities than at Abu Ghraib alone. Mm-hmm. That what some have described as the aberrant acts of a few on the night shift, which did occur at Abu Ghraib, were no more than one slice of a broader problem the military has faced in Iraq and Afghanistan.
And what is the Defense Department saying about these 26 suspicious deaths?
The Pentagon's saying they've never quite seen the numbers added up this way, which is a bit of raises some questions on its own. They're saying that, again, one death is too many and that all are being vigorously investigated. But their own most recent report presented to Congress last week had a cutoff date in terms of the information it considered of last September. So that report told Congress that there had just been six of these suspicious deaths. Either no one asked the question or didn't review the answer to discover that the current figure is much, much higher.
Doug Gell, Washington correspondent for The New York Times. He writes about this report of 26 deaths, many ruled homicides, in a result of prison detainees in Iraq and Afghanistan in today's New York Times. Doug, thank you.
Thank you.
Just ahead, Boston's Big Dig, a miracle of transportation, but is it safe? And later in the show, a Pentagon audit says Halliburton may have overcharged the government for services provided in Iraq. We'll go right to the floor of Congress to speak to Congressman Henry Waxman. There's more coming up here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Other news we're following today. President Bush tapped Deputy Defense Secretary Paul Wolfowitz to take over as head of the World Bank. In a news conference at the White House, the president described Wolfowitz as a compassionate, decent man who will do a fine job at the World Bank.
He helped manage a large organization. World Bank's a large organization. The Pentagon's a large organization. He's been involved in the management of that organization. He's a skilled diplomat, worked at the State Department, and high positions. He's the ambassador to Indonesia.
But Wolfowitz has also been a lightning rod for criticism. Before the U.S.-led war in Iraq, he was one of the strongest voices in the administration, arguing that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction. And Wolfowitz predicted that Americans would be greeted as liberators upon invading the country. The World Bank's 24-member board is expected to confirm the nomination. In his news conference this morning, the president was also asked about the withdrawal of Italian troops from Iraq. The president said he spoke by telephone to Italian Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi.
I said, first of all, he wanted me to know that there was no change in his policy, that in fact any withdrawals would be done in consultation with allies and would be done depending upon the ability of Iraqis to defend themselves.
The president also praised newly elected Iraqi lawmakers for their historic meeting of today's parliament.
Iraq had a meeting today of its transitional National Assembly. It's a bright moment in what is a process toward the writing of a constitution, the ratification of the constitution.
On Capitol Hill, the House approved an $81.4 billion emergency spending package for combat and reconstruction in Iraq and Afghanistan. President Bush received most of what he had requested. The Senate will consider its version of the bill next month. Well, the nation's largest public works project is once again the source of controversy. The Big Dig, the $14.6 billion highway reconstruction project, has been remaking downtown Boston and snarling traffic for years. Now, one engineer involved in the project says he cannot say with confidence that the project's spanking new tunnels are safe to carry traffic beneath the streets of Boston and under Boston Harbor. You'll remember we've been reporting for months about leaks in the tunnels. One breach in September caused a flood which backed up traffic for miles, and the whole underground system has been under scrutiny since. Now, in addition to an independent investigation into the leaks, Massachusetts Attorney General Thomas Riley is opening a fraud investigation into Big Dig contractors, Bechtel, Parsons, Brinkerhoff, and Modern Continental. Riley tells the Boston Globe the probe will focus on what he calls poor oversight and shoddy work in a project that's been plagued by missed deadlines and cost overruns. The controversy has also prompted Governor Mitt Romney to renew his effort to oust the chairman of the Turnpike Authority, Matt Amarillo. Well, there's more, and here now's Martha Biebinger has it.
Turnpike Chairman Matt Amarillo says the authority is certain the Big Dig tunnels are secure.
Let me start by assuring you that the I-93 tunnels are safe and structurally sound. That was the case when we opened the tunnels in 2003. That was the case even after last September's slurry wall breach. And it remains the case today. If there were ever a hint that public safety was in jeopardy, I promise you we would close the tunnels immediately.
But in the letter that triggered Amarillo's comments yesterday, consultant Jack Lemley reverses public safety assurances he made last fall. Lemley says problems with water leaks and damaged fireproofing appear worse now, but he can't be sure because records he requested late last year and into January were not released. Amarillo says he appreciates Lemley's work, but says Lemley shouldn't expect to have received information after his contract ended in December and the cost recovery effort moved to the Attorney General's office. Amarillo contradicts claims that the authority wouldn't share project reports.
Since I became chairman in February 2002, we have been as transparent as possible, and anyone who says otherwise is ill-informed at best and disingenuous at worst.
But Governor Mitt Romney says Lemley's complaints are just the latest example of the Turnpike withholding information, and he blames Amarillo.
With the Big Dig, there's been a pattern of cover-up and stonewalling that has left the public with little confidence that the project is being managed well or that the road and tunnel system are safe for travel.
Romney wants to remove Amarillo as chairman of the authority. Amarillo says he won't resign. So the governor is asking the state's highest court whether he has the power to demote Amarillo. There is a relevant case. In May of 2002, the Supreme Judicial Court told then-acting Governor Jane Swift to reinstate two Turnpike board members she had fired. Boston College Law School professor Robert Bloom says the court ruled that a governor has no supervisory power over the Turnpike Authority unless he or she can prove egregious wrongdoing. Bloom says the court didn't define that standard, but did offer some guidelines about what Governor Romney will have to establish regarding Amarillo.
Terms like malfeasance or willful neglect of duty would tend to indicate intentional disregard of their responsibilities as Turnpike Authority heads.
Governor Romney says he'll try to avoid the protracted legal battle that stalled Turnpike business for months 3 years ago. The letter from consultant Lemley is another blow for Boston-area drivers. Amid Big Dig construction near South Station, many commuters say it may not be possible to restore confidence in the project.
Don't want any part of driving through that tunnel. It's unsafe. Will not go through the tunnel. It's not worth it.
It makes me a little nervous going through the tunnel, worrying about leaks. still have to go through to get to the other side.
If there's leaks, what a God knows what else is wrong. Maybe something's wrong with the infrastructure or something. I feel really betrayed.
The Turnpike Authority says there are 44 defects in the walls that hold back water around the tunnels, but that 42 need only minor repairs. A determination about the extent of water damage to fireproofing is ongoing, as are the investigations about who is at fault for damage and cost overruns and who will pay. $81 million in federal funds is still on hold until the Turnpike Authority delivers a full report on tunnel leaks and repair costs.
That report from Here Now's Martha Biebinger. And tomorrow on Here and Now, inside the Kenyan Mau Mau Uprising. That's tomorrow. Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. This week, part of a Defense Department audit was released showing that oil services giant Halliburton may have overcharged the government by more than $100 million for work done in Iraq. The report examined one section of a $2.5 billion no-bid contract for fuel transport and repairs of Iraqi oil facilities done by the Halliburton subsidiary Kellogg, Brown & Root. California Congressman Henry Waxman released the audit summary, and he's calling on the White House to make audits of other Halliburton contracts public as well. He spoke with Here Now's Bob Oakes just moments ago from the House floor.
Congressman, let me ask you first of all, what's the report say? How did Halliburton or its subsidiary do this?
Halliburton overcharged over $100 million for the fuel that they brought into Iraq. Some of the money they used to pay for this was Iraq's money for their oil for food funds that we were entrusted to be the supervisor over. Some of it was U.S. taxpayers' money. But the Pentagon auditors have confirmed that there was at least $100 million that were overcharged. And in fact, in one case, they were spending $27 million to bring in $80,000 of fuel, which is an incredible price just for transporting it. It would be equivalent to going and getting $1 worth of fuel and then spending $330 to bring it in. And of course, it was sold at discounted prices in Iraq itself. But that they didn't care how much they overcharged. They paid their subcontractors, because the more they charged, the more profit they made. They had a cost-plus contract.
Halliburton says, in its defense, that the audit doesn't take into account the fact that the work was urgent, needed to be done right away, and was done in a war zone, and that under those circumstances, the prices they charged, although it might seem high to many, the prices they charged were fair.
The civilian person in charge of doing contracting for the United States wanted to insist that Halliburton, KBR, their subsidiary, contract with someone other than a company called Altamia, because Altamia was charging such a high price and there were others who could sell the fuel and get it to the right place at a much lower charge. Our U.S. ambassador in Kuwait insisted that Halliburton give the contract to Altamia. And even though the head of Altamira was saying that KBR or Halliburton was asking for kickbacks, so it was there was political pressure evidently to get this contract, even though it was overpaying. When we finally got around to dealing with this subject, the U.S. government made a contract with Altamira, and we're paying them a third of the price that Halliburton was charging overall for the gas and for bringing it into Iraq.
The version of the report that you released seems also to say that there were systematic weaknesses that allowed this to happen.
There were systematic weaknesses in the way Halliburton was keeping its records, the way they were handling their affairs. They just didn't seem to care about how much they paid. Now, all of this was in a report sent to the United Nations. The reason it was sent to the United Nations is the UN voted to empower the U.S. to deal with the Iraqi oil funds on behalf of the Iraqi people, and we were supposed to be accountable for it. Well, when we sent the reports to the United Nations, statements like Halliburton was in charge and couldn't be kept accountable or overcharged, I'm characterizing that quoting, those were all redacted out. And what we found was that Halliburton insisted that our government redact information that we were sending to the UN just because they didn't want to be embarrassed about statements that the Pentagon auditors said were true. It's certainly not proprietary information to say that Halliburton couldn't be accountable for all the money that they were spending. That statement alone is not a trade secret, and yet they got the Pentagon auditors to help them try to cover it up.
The audit dated October of last year, 6 months ago. Why hasn't it been released until now?
Because it had been redacted. The information that was given to the UN and to Congress was a redacted version through other sources. We were able to get the unredacted version, and just to simply compare the two, it was obvious that the Pentagon auditors were doing what Halliburton asked them to do, to redact it, which isn't their job. It's certainly contrary to their job, because they shouldn't be involved in helping cover it up. Their job should be to help us get that money back from Halliburton.
And I think that's the next question. What do you do to get the money back?
Well, I think we ought to withhold money from Halliburton. This is the usual way you do things. You withhold money on future contracts for overcharges on the past work, but the government, our government, has refused to do that, and we've never gotten a good explanation. Not only have they refused to withhold money for the overcharges in the past, they gave Halliburton a bonus within the last couple of weeks for doing such a great job.
Do you worry, are you concerned that that overcharging, maybe not for these specific reasons and in the continued delivery of fuel in Iraq, but do you suspect that overcharging is continuing?
I do suspect that overcharging is continuing. We have auditors continuing to audit, and every report we get is that that we ought to be wary of this sort of thing and clamp down, but then Pentagon itself keeps on issuing further contracts. I have to go vote.
California Congressman Henry Waxman is a member of the House Committee on Government Reform. He spoke with Here and Now's Bob Oakes. And this news today from the Middle East, the West Bank town of Jericho is officially under Palestinian control. After a brief delay, Israelis and Palestinians held a signing ceremony for the handover. The ceremony was delayed when Palestinians and Israelis couldn't agree on whether to seal the Jericho deal with a handshake or by signing a document. The Palestinians demanded a deal in writing. Jericho is the first of five West Bank towns returning to Palestinian control. Israel seized control after the outbreak of fighting in 2000. And in Lebanon, the militant group Hezbollah is reacting positively to President Bush's call that it move into the political mainstream. In an interview with Al Arabiya Television, a Hezbollah leader praised the statement as a new and welcome approach from the U.S., one that's compatible with European efforts. The U.S. currently labels Hezbollah a terrorist organization. Its leaders have organized two huge rallies in support of Syria's military presence in Lebanon. Well, as always, we welcome your thoughts on the program. Send us an email at letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. Or you can call our listener line and leave us a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. Please remember to tell us how to pronounce your full name and tell us the town you're from. Just ahead, choreographer Mark Morris. And you're listening to Here and Now. In a surprise move, Harvard University's Faculty of Arts and Sciences has passed a motion saying it lacks confidence in the leadership of Harvard President Lawrence Summers. Here now, reporter Fred Tice joins us now in the studio to fill us in. And Fred, first off, I'm guessing this is a huge blow to Lawrence Summers.
It is a huge deal, because no one, not even the supporters of this motion, expected it to garner more than about a third of the vote. To be told by the faculty of one of Harvard's main schools, which is the four-year undergraduate college, plus all the graduate schools for sciences, the social sciences, the arts, the humanities, basically everything at Harvard but the professional schools, that you don't have their confidence, that's a huge step back.
And how many people attended the event?
More than 500 of the faculty's nearly 700 professors showed up. So many people were expected that they held the meeting at Harvard's Drama Center.
And how did they take the vote? How did they find this out?
The motion said, the faculty lacks confidence in the leadership of Lawrence Summers. It passed by a vote of 218 to 185, and a fair number of people didn't vote.
So how did Lawrence Summers react?
Well, after the vote, Summers made a brief statement to reporters while protesters were trying to shout him down.
My hope now is that our faculty will be in a position to move forward strongly on the important issues that it faces. Thank you.
Summers was followed by a gaggle of reporters and a small mob of protesters shouting at him as he walked along the theater until he could cross the street and duck into a waiting car. The faculty also passed another motion regretting Summers' statements about women in math and science at a conference in January. At that conference, Summers had floated the idea that intrinsic differences between men and women may account for the fact that there are so few women in top science positions. Professor of Yiddish and Comparative Literature Ruth Weiss says Summers was pilloried at yesterday's faculty meeting.
It strikes me as being quite astonishing. It reflects very badly on the Faculty of Arts and Science and on those people who voted to censure him for statements that were made, for opinions that were expressed.
But Professor of Anthropology and African and African American Studies J. Laurent Matori, the sponsor of the No Confidence motion, disagrees.
This resolution is not about Lawrence Summers' lack of a right to express his opinion about issues. It is largely about his managerial style, which has been dictatorial and autocratic.
Matori says he's surprised that his motion carried.
I had expected maybe 30% of the faculty to vote in favor of this resolution.
The motion doesn't carry any official weight, but Matori says Summers should step down now.
He should resign as president of the university and clear the path for a civil choice of a replacement. The university does not care for his style of leadership.
Few expect Summers will step down. The 218 professors who voted against him, while a majority of those present at the faculty meeting, still represent a minority of the nearly 700 professors on the faculty. And the Faculty of Arts and Sciences is only one of Harvard's 12 schools. Harvard Law Professor Alan Dershowitz is a supporter of Summers.
It's only the Faculty of Arts and Sciences, not the law school, the graduate schools, the students, the alumni, and it represents only a relatively small part of the Faculty of Arts and Sciences. And it represents a view that's not the consensus on the Harvard campus by any means.
The Harvard Corporation, Harvard's governing body, are the only ones who can fire Summers. But last night, James Houghton, the senior fellow of the corporation, issued a statement saying the corporation fully supports him.
Well, so why was everyone caught off guard by this vote?
Well, some of the faculty say it's because it was a secret ballot. Many professors have said that they're afraid of Summers, and they may not have wanted to come out openly against him, because although they're tenured, he still has a say in their budgets and in their salaries. And it does show just how deep the discontent is against Summers, at least in the Faculty of Arts and Sciences.
So, Fred Tice, has anything like this ever happened in Harvard history?
Nope.
And what happens now?
Well, this is completely uncharted territory for Harvard.
So we will find out.
Yeah.
And you'll be there for us. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Here and now, Fred Tice. Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The Mark Morris Dance Group is currently out on a national tour, a perfect time, we thought, to look at one source of inspiration for the troupe's founder, who earlier in his career was sometimes called the bad boy of modern dance. That's Slaughter on 10th Avenue from the Richard Rodgers 1936 musical On Your Toes. Now, Slaughter on 10th Avenue, you'll remember, was the big ballet number within the musical On Your Toes. Originally, Russian choreographer George Balanchine made it a story of gangsters and a stripper, and it's inspired many a choreographer, including Mark Morris. He was asked to recreate the work, and he had a completely different take from Balanchine. We caught up with Mark Morris at a theater on 10th Avenue in New York as he and television director Bill Cosell videotaped the dance for PBS.
Everybody, when the gunshot goes off, you should all think you did it.
Well, let's go from the top, please, Mark. Okay, come back a little bit looser, David. Now we're going to go off in couples and start cheating back, Jeff. Coming back, Jeff. Coming back. Watch your lower.
The dance is called Resurrection. There's no reference to the Balanchine version at all. You know, in the score, there are two gunshots, and so I have to have somebody die. Somebody gets shot, and then somebody else gets shot later, and then they're reunited in eternity. I decided to work from this music as a piece of music.
Push. Let him bleed out from you. Just keep pushing. That's right. Okay, now you can reframe for the three. The three couples, Dave, reframe.
It's very episodic and switches gears so quickly. I refer to period dances and to period movies. It's, you know, to me, it's sort of a tribute to the incredible choreographer and director Busby Berkeley.
And we now have six couples.
I mean, I want it to be action-packed, this sort of mysterious love story. Some tragedy, some menace, and a big happy ending.
And ready to take them out. Big pose for Dave. And away they go. Good, Dave.
Everything Mr. Berkeley did is incredibly innovative and ahead of its time and sexy and dangerous and exciting. It's just, it's unbelievable work, just every single thing he did. Those movies are supposed to look like the curtain opens in a Broadway theater and suddenly there's like a giant Hollywood soundstage. So in that way, we're shooting everything from the front. There's not much onstage involvement with the cameras, you know, for some special effects stuff. So this dance to the music of Slaughter on 10th Avenue is built specifically cinematically. It's built to look like a big musical movie.
Okay, you're going to have six people running in from both sides. Please, people on the floor for sexy knees.
There's a camera directly over the circle. This looks so genius, you can't even believe it.
My name is Susie Dangle, and I'm the producer of Evening at Pops.
Mark Morris always brings a kind of whimsical quality to whatever he does. He kind of finds the humor in the music. That's what makes Mark different and unique. Da, da, da.
Breezy.
You know, the music is built in very distinct sections, and I choreographed it on purpose that things change in big chunks. So it actually makes the editing of it, the directing of it, much easier than if it were sort of a seamless through narrative kind of thing.
That's it. That's it. And down to the floor they go, and they are dead.
Young, into the future. Open.
This is an homage, but, you know, it's hard to do something that is kind of based in the 30s without it being cute or campy or, you know, too self-conscious. That's the difficulty in reviving period musicals for Broadway, for example. So I want it to be true and legitimate and touching without it being in air quotes. Stand up straight, Sean, all the way up. Okay, that sucked, everybody.
Stand by.
Grand, slow down, legato, and pull.
I kind of wanted to shoot this in black and white, but we're not. Well, you know, really, it's about dancing. This piece is about dancing. And in fact, the director and the designers were surprised at how sort of complicated the dance is. It's very thorough and many, many things happen. And it's relaxing to watch instead of nervous-making to watch.
For more information on the current tour of the Mark Morris Dance Group, go to our website, here-now.org. Big Finish Now. Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston. Our production team includes Lynn Manigan, April Peavy, Karen Miller-Medson, and Stefano Katsonis. Our managing editor is Kathleen McKenna. Vince Fairchild is our engineer. He's assisted by Bob Connolly. Our web producer is Ken George. Our newscast producer, Ann Stevenson. Our interns are Kate Goldring and Danielle Dreilinger. Love this music. The senior producer of Here and Now is Mark Navin. I'm Robin Young. Join us again, Here and Now.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.